20. Talpa. Had that woman in the wheelchair had an IV drip stand in tow, one handing her way across the intersection, the other hand keeping the chrome-plated upright of the stand erect? Had she been legless? Hollis couldn't say, but after the skateboarder with no lower jaw, it didn't seem like that big a deal. "Your company's down here?" she asked Big End, as he turned the Maybach into an alleyway that looked as though a Bradley fighting vehicle would be the wise man's ride of choice. Past a delirious frozen surge of graffiti, a sort of street fractal Hokusai wave, and under a lowering lip of coiled razor wire topping chain-link gates. "Yes," he said, steering onto a concrete ramp rising 15 feet, as it hugged a wall that seemed to her as though it must belong to some city infinitely older than Los Angeles. Babylon, perhaps. It's only graffiti cuneiform and discreet, furtive, clerkish hen-scratchings applied to the odd brick. The Maybach came to a temporary halt on a flat, truck-length platform, facing an articulated metal door. There were bulbous growths of smoked black plastic above this, pods housing cameras, and perhaps other things as well. The door, decorated with a black pointillist portrait of Andre the Giant, Orwellian in scale, rose slowly, Andre's sombre thyroidal gaze giving way to halogen brilliance. Big End drove forward into a hangar-like space, smaller than Bobby Chombo's empty factory, but still impressive. Half a dozen identical silver sedans were parked there, in a row, beside a brand new yellow forklift and tall, tidy stacks of new gypsum wallboard. Big End stopped the car. A ball-capped guard in black uniform shorts and matching short-sleeved shirt regarded them from behind mirrored glasses. A laden, multi-compartmented black holster was strapped to his right thigh. She felt a sudden, intense desire to get out of the Maybach and acted on it. The door opened like some disturbing hybrid of bank vault and Armani evening purse, perfectly balanced bomb-proof solidity meeting sheer cosmetic slickness. The gritty concrete floor, blotched with crumbs of gypsum, felt comforting in contrast. The guard gestured with a remote. She heard segmented steel start to rattle down behind them. "This way, please," said Big End, over the clatter of the closing door. He stepped away from the Maybach without bothering to close his door, so she left hers open as well and followed him. She looked back, just as she was catching up with him, and saw it sitting open, its interior a soft, mouth-like cavern of grey lambskin under the high-resolution brilliance of the garage's lighting. "We're losing the better part of the neighbourhood's edge as the reclamation continues," he said, guiding her around a 10-foot stack of drywall.
"Better part?"
"Majority of. I'll miss it myself. It unsettles visitors. Unsettled is good. Last week we opened a new suite of offices in Beijing. I'm not satisfied. Not at all. 3 floors in a new building. Really nothing we could do with them. But it's Beijing." He shrugged. "What choice do we have?" She didn't know, so said nothing. He led her up a wide flight of stairs and into what was obviously in the process of becoming a foyer. Another guard, studying CCTV windows on a panel display, ignored them. They stepped into an elevator, its every surface taped over with white dusted layers of corrugated cardboard. Big End lifted a flap of the stuff and touched the controls. They rose 2 floors, and the door opened. He gestured for her to go ahead. She stepped out onto a scuffed runway of more of the same cardboard, taped across a floor of some smooth grey product. The cardboard ran to a conference table, 6 chairs on a side. Above this, on the wall beyond, hung Anton Corbijn's portrait of her in perfect resolution on a screen, perhaps 30 feet on the diagonal. "A wonderful image," he said, as she looked from it back to him. "I've never been entirely comfortable with it." "Because the celebrity self is a sort of tulpa," he said.
"A what?"
"A projected thought form. A term from Tibetan mysticism. The celebrity self has a life of its own. It can, under the right circumstances, indefinitely survive the death of its subject. That's what every Elvis sighting is about, literally."
All of which reminded her very much of how Inchmail looked at these things, though really she believed it too. "What happens," she asked him, "if the celebrity self dies first?"
"Very little," he said. "That's usually the problem. But images of this calibre serve as a hedge against that. And music is the most purely atemporal of media."
"The past isn't dead. It's not even past."
Quoting Inchmail, quoting Faulkner.
"Would you mind changing channels?"
He gestured toward the screen. The hook appeared in her place, the Soviet cargo helicopter, photographed from below. "What do you make of all this?"
The smile flashed like a lighthouse.
There were no apparent windows in this room, and at the moment, this screen was the sole source of light.
"You like unsettled?"
"Yes."
"Then you like me."
"I do like you. And something would be very wrong if you weren't unsettled." She went to the conference table and ran a finger along its black surface, leaving a faint trace in gypsum dust.
"Is there really a magazine?"
"Everything," said Big End, "is potential."
"Everything," she said, "is potential bullshit.
Think of me as a patron, please."
"I don't like the sound of that, thanks."
"In the early 1920s, Big End said, "there were still some people in this country who hadn't yet heard recorded music. Not many, but a few. That's less than 100 years ago. Your career as a recording artist," making the quotes with his hands, "took place toward the end of a technological window that lasted less than 100 years, a window during which consumers of recorded music lacked the means of producing that which they consumed. They could buy recordings, but they couldn't reproduce them. The curfew came in as that monopoly on the means of production was starting to erode. Prior to that monopoly, musicians were paid for performing, published and sold sheet music, or had patrons. The pop star, as we know her," and here he bowed slightly in her direction, "was actually an artifact of pre-ubiquitous media.
Of
a state in which mass media existed, if you will, within the world.
As opposed to
comprising it."
The light in the room changed as he said this. She raised her eyes to the screen, where a metallic blue ant glyph had taken over the screen. "What's in Chombo's container?" she asked.
"It's not Chombo's container."
"Your container."
"It's not our container."
"Our being you and who?"
"You."
"It's not my container."
"Just as I said," said Big End, and smiled.
"Whose is it, then?"
"I don't know. But I believe you might be able to find out."
"What's in it?"
"We don't know that either."
"What does Chombo have to do with it?"
"Chombo, evidently, has found a way to know where it is, at least periodically."
"Why don't you just ask him?"
"Because it's a secret. He's being paid handsomely to keep it a secret, and his personality is such, as you've noted, that he likes having a secret."
"Who's paying him, then?"
"That seems to be even more of a secret."
"Do you think it might be the container's owner?"
"Or its ultimate addressee, should it ever acquire one. I don't know. But you, Hollis,
are the person I found whom Bobby is most likely to talk to. You weren't there. He wasn't that glad to have Alberto bring me around. There were no suggestions of further invitations. That's where I'm convinced you're wrong, he said. When he's gotten used to the idea that you're available for more FaceTime, you may well hear from him.
What have iPods got to do with it?
He raised an eyebrow.
Roush told me to look for iPods being used for data storage. Do people still do that?
Chombo periodically loads an iPod with data and sends it out of the United States.
What kind of data?
Music, ostensibly. We've had no way of finding out.
Do you know where he sends them?
San Jose, Costa Rica, so far. We have no idea where else it might go, from there.
Who receives it?
Someone whose job is to run an expensive post office box, essentially. There's a lot of that, evidently, in San Jose. We're working on it. Have you been there?
No.
There's quite a community of retired CIA people there. DEA as well. We have someone there now, trying to have a quiet look into things, though so far it doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
Why are you so interested in the contents of Chombo's container?
Big End removed a pale blue microfiber dustcloth from his jacket pocket, pulled a chair out on its casters, and gave it a good dusting. Seat?
He offered her the chair. No, thanks. Go ahead.
He seated himself. He looked up at her. I've learned to value anomalous phenomena. Very peculiar things that people do, often secretly, have come to interest me in a certain way. I spend a lot of money, often, trying to understand those things. From them, sometimes, emerge Blue Ant's most successful efforts. Tropeslope, for instance, our viral pitchman platform, was based on pieces of anonymous footage being posted on the net.
You did that? Put that thing in the background of all those old movies? That's fucking horrible.
Pardon my French. It sells shoes.
He smiled. So what do you expect to get out of this, if you can find out what's in Chombo's container?
No idea. None whatever. That's exactly what makes it so interesting.
I don't get it.
Intelligence, Hollis, is advertising turned inside out.
Which means?
Secrets, said Big End, gesturing toward the screen, are cool. On the screen appeared their images, standing beside the table, Big End not yet seated, captured by a camera somewhere above. The Big End on the screen took a pale blue cloth from his pocket, pulled out a chair, and began to dust its arms and back and seat. Secrets, said the Big End beside her, are the very root of cool.